Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Flavor is powerful. Flavor holds memories, stories. The flavors of American cuisine and culture come from all over. Their stories may surprise you. This hour, On Point food historian Sarah Lohman on the 8 flavors that she says define America's culinary and cultural history. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What flavors taste American these days to you? Is your kitchen spice rack a window on the world? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Sarah Lohman, food historian and culinary author, creator of the blog 4 Pounds Flour. Her new book is 8 Flavors, The Untold Story of American Cuisine. Sarah Lohman, welcome to On Point. Great to have you.
It's so great to be here. Thanks for having me, Tom.
So I guess by definition, this has got to be about some stories from all over the place, right? I mean, if you think about American cuisine, by definition, it always had to be this crazy quilt of English and Dutch and Spanish and African, Native American, French. We have always been a coat of many colors here.
Yeah, absolutely. But at the same time, we can't say there's stories from all over. There's stories from all over America. But at this book, I'm really looking at the last 200 years of our history. And I'm looking at the idea of who an American is, too. The people behind these flavors, the people behind our culture and our country.
And I saw your list of 8. And I don't know what I expected, but I guess because you stretch it over an entire 200 years, we really do have flavors from all over here. You've got 8, and they are that before I name them, these are 8 flavors that what? Fill in the blank, Sarah.
Are some of the most dominant flavors in American cooking, meaning we use them the most. And that's it, with a couple exceptions, a couple stories I decided not to tell. And they're laid out chronologically in my book. And they're flavors that aren't trendy. They appeared in our kitchen pantries for one reason or another and then have not gone away, are still a part of American cooking to this day.
The couple that you carved out, I'll just give it away. They're chocolate and coffee. And you carved those out because?
Well, there's just been a lot of other work about those two flavors. Talking about the history of chocolate and coffee, those are entire books unto themselves, and there are some incredible books out there about it. So I decided to exclude those two because I wanted to sort of I wanted to look at American cuisine in this broader way and really pick out flavors and ingredients that we haven't really questioned or talked about its history before, whose stories have been written a lot less. I'd even add one that I didn't mention in my introduction. I'll even add cinnamon, too. A lot of people have been asking me about that because is definitely, especially around the holidays, something that a lot of people are using. The cinnamon chapter would have come before my first chapter, the one that I picked in this book. So in a way, it sort of predates our country. I really start after the Revolutionary War. That's one big reason, but also cinnamon is used a lot in cuisines all over the planet. And also these 8 flavors are things that Americans seem to have a particular love of. So that's something I wanted to focus on, too.
Yeah, I was missing cinnamon here. A couple of other things I want to ask you about. But let me drum roll here. Here are the 8. And you can think about these, dear listeners, flavors that dominate American cooking and through that sort of culture and stories. Number 1, black pepper, then vanilla, chili powder, curry powder, she says, soy sauce, garlic, monosodium glutamate, MSG, and sriracha. Okay, there's the list. Black pepper, vanilla, chili, curry, soy, garlic, MSG, sriracha. How did you come up with these, Sarah?
Well, I had a couple different techniques. I started by simply looking at cookbooks from different time periods. I've got a pretty good collection myself, but there's also Google Books and another site called Feeding America, which lets you look at historic cookbooks from different time periods. I started with the first cookbook published in America in 1796, American Cooking by Amelia Simmons, and went all the way to contemporary classics like Mark Bittman's How to Cook Everything. Mm-hmm. And I just looked at the recipes and I made notes of what ingredients were being being used more than once. Not things like flour or sugar, but what ingredients are affecting the flavor of these foods. And I made lists by time period, by decade. And then from those lists, I began looking and saying, okay, which ones are mentioned the most? I used a really cool tool called the Google Ngram Viewer. Google has let you search all of the books that it has digitized by word. So you can
plug
in a term.
Which is a lot of books.
Oh, my! In the tens of millions, I believe. And you can even focus in time periods like 1800 to 2000. And you can even focus on American books, too. So I can punch in a word like black pepper and I can compare it to something else like curry powder and see. And it visualizes. It plots this data on a graph over time. So you can see the sort of peaks and valleys and how much these words are being used. So it not only let me look at trends, not only let me look at the moment when a word began being used a lot more and therefore probably being used a lot more in the kitchen, but it also allowed me to compare. So I can look at something like garlic versus basil and say, oh, garlic is being used much, much, much more than something like basil. So that's telling me something there.
And you clearly stretch this over time. I mean, if you go back to the revolutionary era, you're not going to find much soy sauce, not even much garlic, of course. That came with a large immigration wave of Italians and more in the late 19th, early 20th century. I mean, you're really stretching this right up into our current fullness of culture.
Absolutely. But I have to say one of the things that surprised me was often how far back we were using certain ingredients. Although you don't really see a bump in the data for soy sauce until the late 19th century when Chinese takeout is becoming popular. The first soy sauce brewed in the Western Hemisphere was made in Georgia in 1767. So it is actually quite an old American ingredient that was being used by English immigrants and then later came again through Chinese immigrants and then later was made popular through Japanese immigrants.
What? Wait a minute. Chinese takeout was popular in 1890? For real?
It was.
I don't believe it.
Right where I am in New York City. There's a quote from the turn of the century that says that no bohemian gathering is complete without a bucket of chop suey hot and fresh from Chinatown.
Okay.
So it was
the
first takeout food.
I don't know how widely it was spread, but in New York City, I don't doubt it, and maybe some other great places as well. They're amazing.
Yeah, San Francisco too.
Yeah, sure. There are amazing stories behind how these things got introduced. Being a nation of immigrants and a nation of, was being said right now, global trade for a long time. Yeah. Tell us the black pepper story. It comes right out of old Yankee New England, but it stretches just as far as you can go. How did that become such a staple of early American cuisine?
Well, black pepper is something we have been cooking with as a colony, too. I really start the book by looking at Martha Washington's papers, and she has a collection of recipes that's called A Book of Cookery by contemporary culinary historians. And I looked at how many times black pepper is used in her book, and it's a lot. It's over 60 times.
Even in cookies.
including in cookies and sweet recipes, which I think is really
wild.
Cool. And another recipe that is like the forefather of a steak au poivre, you know, the fancy like French crusted in it. There's a version in her book that uses venison instead of beef, which I think is really cool. Both of those recipes, by the way, are in my book. I like to give people a little taste of the past they can try themselves.
But bringing that pepper to American tables took an extraordinary leap of trade.
It did, because we were buying pepper through Britain, like most of our commodities, which was part of what started the Revolutionary War, the highly taxed goods that were being sold and bought from England. And after the war, well, England had kept where black pepper was coming from a secret. So we wanted it, and we didn't know where to get it. And essentially, someone was on the other side of the planet, in Indonesia, trading for spices, and they got a hot tip that black pepper was grown on the northwest coast of Sumatra. So a group of traders in Salem, they put together money. Salem, Massachusetts, one of your neighbors. Mm-hmm. Now more famous for witches, but at one time known as the black pepper capital of pretty much the world.
Well, the Yankee traders sailed out of there and more.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So there are these families from Salem that put together money, put together voyages, go to Sumatra, and the first time the black pepper is brought directly to the United States. It starts in 1795, but by the middle of the 19th century, we have our first millionaires in America because of the black pepper trade. And I think that the really cool part about it is we stole the trade from the British, and we did it by being nice. The British were imposing colonial rule. They were punishing people. They were paying poverty wages for pepper. But we really liked the local people, the Akanis. We paid them a fair wage. We tried to befriend them. And because of that, we totally stole the trade away from England.
Flash forward a couple hundred years, and here's celebrity chef Emeril Lagasse describing the ingredients for beef tenderloin with fresh horseradish and black pepper crust.
We're about to kick it up a notch, Louisiana style. Plan on about 4 servings per pound of tenderloin. Bring it home, season it up with salt and cracked black pepper.
Bring it home with cracked black pepper, and that makes it into your all-star list of American flavors right there. Would it help you recognize American food above and beyond another cuisine when that black pepper hits the palate?
I think so. Although black pepper is a staple of many foods, particularly European foods, too, the quantities we use it in are pretty exceptional. And actually, I theorize that that's because of the Food Network. Because for most of the 20th century, you probably remember having a shaker of ground black pepper, you know, on your kitchen table. Yep. I certainly do.
There it was.
But the quantity of black pepper we've consumed over the past approximately 20 years, really since the Food Network launched, has increased by about 80%. And I think a lot of that has to do with Nonus Emerald says cracked black pepper. He doesn't say grab your pepper shaker.
Right. So get the grinder.
Get the grinder, right, the pepper mill. And before that had really only been in fancy restaurants. And I think it was the Food Network that made people realize that they could bring quality food into their own homes. So Americans and their kitchens started emulating what they saw Emerald doing on TV, got their own pepper grinders, and we've really been consuming even more black pepper now than we ever have before.
Historical gastronomist Sarah Lohman is with us. Her new book is 8 Flavors, The Untold Story of American Cuisine. And the one she gives, black pepper, vanilla, chili powder, curry powder, soy sauce, garlic, MSG, sriracha. Sriracha. Once it was a little calmer sounding when Simon Garfunkel was singing about parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme. You can join us this hour. What do you think? Can we find our history, our story, in the flavors of our food? And what flavor says American to you? Is it the world's flavors, an awful lot of them gathered here? I'm Tom Ashbrook with Sarah Lohman. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Scarborough Fair, parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme. Remember me to one who lives there. She once was a true love of mine.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the flavors that have defined the full story of American culture and cuisine that gather the full richness of American culture, says my guest today. From black pepper to vanilla, chili, soy, garlic, sriracha. She even throws MSG in there. We'll look at that. Sarah Lohman is my guest. Her new book is 8 Flavors, The Untold Story of American Cuisine. You can join us this hour. What flavor says American to you? And what are the dominant flavors of your American story? Are they straight from the old country? Did they change in the migration? Is your spice cabinet now a multicultural gathering, a window on the world? Sarah, defend the thesis here a little bit. We got all kinds of interesting response online, but one of our listeners, Mike, says, flavors that tell the American story? Please. I'm just not buying it. The American story in flavor, like, give us your big thesis again. How do you wrap them together?
Sure. Well, the book, even though I do talk about how certain ingredients are grown or processed, is really not about the ingredients themselves. It's about the people or cultures that brought these flavors to America. So we already talked about the story of black pepper and how that really represented one of our first forays into being a global economic power. Later on, I talk about things like curry powder and soy sauce, which represent different large immigrations coming to this country in the 19th and early 20th century. And even things like sriracha, which was created by a Vietnamese refugee in Southern California. When we look at how our food is put together, it tells us something about who we are as a country, who has come here, why, what drove them here, what drives us to taste new things, and which foods become American, says something about who we are.
Give us a sense of the next one, the stories. I love the stories connecting with these. I mean, vanilla makes your list, mm-hmm. your big 8. We had Ina Garten on a couple of weeks ago. Here she was talking about her sort of a love affair, the Barefoot Contessa love affair with homemade vanilla extract, I guess. Here she is.
When I was at the farmer's market, I saw all these gorgeous artisanal pantry products, and it got me to thinking, What do I have in my pantry? And I realized that homemade vanilla is one of my favorite ingredients. 25 years ago, I made a jar for the house, and I still have it going. And recently, I made another one for the barn. I use it all the time.
All the time, says Ina Garten. Of course, homemade vanilla, I mean, she can't really whip it up out of nothing. Vanilla comes out of a very specific environment. And you look back to how that the flavor was unleashed on the world and very, very heavily adopted in this country. How did it happen, Sarah?
Well, vanilla is actually the fruit of an orchid that's native to Central America, particularly Mexico, where it is still grown in some quantities to this day. But up until the middle of the 19th century, Spain really had a lockdown on vanilla production. And it was very, very, very expensive to buy it because it even if it was grown in Mexico, it was shipped back to Spain. So an American who was trying to buy it was getting it then shipped back to America. So you can imagine how high that price point was. People really loved the flavor, though, and they were sneaking plants out of Mexico, planting them all over the world. But the problem was the plant would flower, but then it wouldn't fruit, which is what was needed to get those vanilla beans. Mm-hmm. Until the early 1840s, there was a plant on the island of Réunion, which used to be called Île de Bourbon, and it's near Madagascar.
Yep.
This was a slaveholding colony of France, and there was a slaveholder, a plantation master. His name was Ferrier Bélier Beaumont, and he had a slave named Edmond, who was a 12-year-old boy. And Beaumont saw in Edmond a brilliance and taught him about botany, which was a passion of Beaumont's. And they would tour the plantation together. And one day they were walking past a vanilla vine, a vine that had flowered but not fruited. And there were a couple big vanilla beans growing on this vine. Mm-hmm. And the story goes, he turned to Edmond and said, "How did this happen?" And Edmond said, "I did it." And so this 12-year-old boy figured out the pollination, the hand pollination technique of vanilla that is still used around the planet today. He eventually gains his freedom, but when you gain your freedom in a culture that Réunion had only recently become a free island, mm-hmm, that there was no longer slavery, there were very few opportunities for a young black man, and he dies fairly young and destitute. So the stories in this book sometimes are really inspiring. You know, we have vanilla in this country because of the brilliance of this enslaved boy who was able to gain his freedom and then just had no opportunities for someone as brilliant as he was.
That life didn't prosper, though. He gave us vanilla and in quantity. And once that quantity was unleashed, how did it make its way into American cuisine? Today we think of it as like second nature, vanilla.
Yeah, absolutely. And what's really fascinating is when you look at American cookbooks before the 1840s, you will rarely find a recipe that uses vanilla. In fact, in those books, they used rose water in all the ways we use vanilla today, which people don't think of rose water as an American ingredient. They think of it as Middle Eastern or Indian. But if you had said that to an American of the early 19th century, they would have looked at you funny because it was absolutely an everyday ingredient here 200 years ago. Then there's a switch is turned on, and suddenly vanilla is everywhere. One of the first people to make it trendy in America is Jefferson, who was a real Francophile. He was obsessed with French cuisine, and the French were obsessed with vanilla. But really, it's this transition of the fact that even when Edmund's hand pollination technique was brought back to Mexico, where there were native pollinators, it still increased the production of vanilla by about 5 times. So there was a lot more vanilla in the world, which means we started making things like, as Ina Garten mentioned, vanilla extract. It was a way to use up less desirable, shorter, broken, uglier beans. And it was cheaper. So a lot more people could buy it and experience it.
Pretty soon it seems absolutely central to American baking. It's just one, though, of this whole concert of flavors, the story of how chili powder became popular here. I mean, we think of it, again, as kind of second nature. Of course it would be. Here we border the cultures and cuisines of Mexico and Central America and beyond. But the way in which chili powder, came up into the American mainstream is an interesting story in itself. Share it with us.
Absolutely, because I think it's a story that reminds us that we don't just border Mexico, we are Mexico. The entire American Southwest was conquered, was won from Mexico during the Mexican-American War. Mm-hmm. So the populations in there are people who live there who are Mexican and are American because their families didn't move. The country changed around them, too. And that's exactly what chili is. We've got some of the first mentions of it from the first half of the 19th century being documented as being made by Mexican women living in Texas. And then as men go to that area during the Mexican-American War, War is a great propagator for new foods. You have men going there and trying the spicy, hot Mexican food for the first time and then coming home with a taste for that. After the war, San Antonio becomes a huge tourist destination. And when people, they go to the Alamo, they visit that. But then the second most popular tourist destination in San Antonio in the 19th century were the Chili Queens. These were families that were set up on the public plazas in front of the Alamo and other areas in San Antonio. And they would set up in the evening. So they were serving an evening and then like a late night crowd at these outdoor restaurants where they served all kinds of Mexican specialties, including chili. And they were sort of ruled by the Chili Queens, which were often young, unmarried women who were there to chat and flirt and sell you some chili. The flavor, though, really becomes American when, in the middle of the 19th century, a German immigrant, we often forget there was a huge German immigration into Texas as well, wanted a shortcut for making chili for his restaurant. And so he develops this dried powder, which then, of course, can be shipped all over the country. He released a cookbook because once chili powder got to Ohio in the 19th century, people really didn't know what to do with it. So he had to educate them. So it's the combination of these two things, many more things than that, actually. This Mexican cooking, this part of Mexico becoming American, this war where soldiers went there, an entrepreneurial German immigrant, all of these things worked to create this American flavor.
Here's a little tape from the Kitchen Sisters' oral history, and it describes, one participant there describes her grandmother's past as a San Antonio chili queen.
I'm Isabel Sanchez. I was born in San Antonio, Texas. My grandmother's name was Teresa Cantu Rocha. She was a chili queen. She was around at that time. What I would hear from my mother, they had tables. They were outside.
And of course, pretty soon you had chili powder in kitchen spice racks and cabinets all over the country. Sarah Lohman is with us. Her new book is Eight Flavors, The Untold Story of American Cuisine. Jesse in Myrtle Beach is calling. Hi, Jesse. You're on the air with Sarah.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What's on your mind?
Yes, I had a question. We're talking about these flavors, and I'm particularly born and raised in the South, and down here we do a lot of the fried foods.
Sure.
However, we do more of a baked and rotisserie now, seemingly, is becoming more and more popular. But my question was, as far as the frying food, in the difference of, like, potatoes, whether you fry the potatoes in grease or whether you bake them in an oven, the flavor, the taste is different. Would you categorize the grease as a flavor enhancer versus a flavor in itself because of the difference in the flavor, the taste of those said French fries?
Oh, I love it. We get the esoterica of flavor here. Is grease a flavor?
Yeah, I think that's really interesting, Jesse. That really touches on a lot of things, too. So in my introduction, and you mentioned it too, Tom, mm-hmm. I really talk about flavor as being this combination of taste and aroma, and that these two things are processed in our frontal lobe, which is also where memory is processed. But that's not the only things that contribute to flavor. Texture, temperature, those are two other really important factors, and maybe even things like fattiness. There's even some debate right now if fattiness is one of our primary tastes, because there are five primary tastes right now: sweet, sour, bitter, umami. Which one am I forgetting? Sweet, sour, bitter, umami. Salty?
Salty.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and the umami, the savory flavor, that has really only been added in the past 15 years. So we, for a long time, said there are four basic tastes. Now we say there are five. And now we're looking to see if there might be more.
But I don't see the flavor of fried food on your list. So what does that mean?
Well, because I narrowed my book's focus in terms of ingredients. But what I'm also saying is what Jesse brings up is a valid point, that fattiness is now being researched as being a taste because it's textural as well as that there's a flavor to it. And he's absolutely right. The way that you're processing your food makes it makes the flavor of it different. So although I'm focusing on ingredients to tell the story, flavor is really complicated and has a lot of contributions. I also think that Jesse's story talks about regionality, which is really important too, that America has a vastly diverse culinary history, and a lot of it has to do with regionality, where you grow up is how you do things, and also where your family is from, too. Where would that original immigration come from? So what I tried to do with my book, too, is I was curious about the things that unite us all despite these regional and perhaps ethnic or immigration differences. And I was curious why we could find a bottle of vanilla, maybe in your kitchen in New England, but also maybe in Jesse's kitchen in Florida, too. So I was that's what I was looking at. What is that uniting factor and using these flavors to help define cuisine?
Jesse in South Carolina, we appreciate your call. I asked a friend, what's the American flavor? And she immediately said, barbecue sauce. Well, that one's out there, too. We're talking about flavors that have defined the full story of American culture, cuisine. Let's go to Mark in Portland, Maine. Mark, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you. Great piece here. I had the good fortune of living in a nice melting pot area in basically Baltimore, Maryland,
okay,
where they have a number of communities, Pakistani, Indian, Mexican and Southwest American cuisine. And I noticed over the last couple of decades sort of a one key spice going through there, and it was smoked paprika. And it's gotten to the point where I'm so in love with it that I make rubs with it, and it's kind of my secret ingredient. Right?
Your secret has been given away, Mark.
Yeah, I'll have to look into that now.
I love it. And that even out of an area where you've got Indian and Pakistani and Mexican all using smoked paprika. Paprika doesn't make your list, but curry does, surprisingly. I mean, of course, we've got a large immigrant population from South Asia here now. You take us back to just how early that curry influx began, Sarah.
Yes, absolutely. Curry came to this country really in two separate waves. Because of British colonialism, England is well obsessed with curry. And so sure, some of the first cookbooks carried here by English immigrants had curry recipes in them. And we had recipes for curry in American cookbooks as early as the 1820s. We were cooking with curry powder and making sort of anglicized curries in this country since the early 19th, if not the late 18th centuries. But then we also see our first immigrants coming from Bangladesh, modern-day Bangladesh, in the 1880s. And I outline the story of a very prominent immigrant from modern-day Pakistan, from Karachi, although when he left it was India, named Ranji Smail, who came to this country in 1899 and became a celebrity chef, much on par with Emeril Lagasse or Ina Garten, and toured the country and was always in the gossip columns and really strove to try to bring authentic Indian cooking, or at least what he thought was authentic Indian cooking, or how he interpreted it for an American audience, to this country. So it's been around a very, very, very long time.
We've got celebrity chef Floyd Cardoz is known for his kind of kaleidoscopic menus. They filter American favorites through traditional South Asian lens. And here's a little bit of an interview on CBS this morning where he describes, talk about American, he talks about a trademark watermelon dish that's also a curry dish.
One of the dishes that I came up with before I opened Tabla was a watermelon curry. It was my son, Peter. He was 6 years old, and he was eating watermelon that day. And he asked me, he said, Dad, do you do everything with spice in India? And then he asked me if I'd make a curry with watermelon. And I did, and it went on my menu, was there for almost 12 years. And I may be bringing it back to my new restaurant, North End Grill, next week, because it's this freshness of summer, and it's absolutely, you know, a mix of sweet and sour and salty. And it's about how food should be.
Sweet, sour, salty, the freshness of summer, and kind of an ultimate fusion idea there, Sarah. Curry and watermelon,
yeah.
Boom, you're in America.
Yeah, and you know what? I don't even think of these foods as fusion anymore. That's a word that we used maybe 20 years ago as we began sort of openly combining cuisine. But now modern chefs like Cardoz, they're saying things like, no, this is just a result of what it's like to live in America.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. You know, you have all these cultures living next to each other, not just from different countries, but when you talk about an Indian neighborhood or a Pakistan neighborhood, there are people from all over that country who wouldn't have known each other back home, who come from different culinary backgrounds that are now living blocks away from each other, sharing food, sharing ingredients, sharing smoked paprika in that case. So there's also this sort of lateral appropriation going on even within that first generation of immigration. So the food we're making here is, a lot of people call it inauthentic. It's not like it was at home. Of course not. We're a different country. The food is evolving and growing, and that's because we get to look around, see what others are doing.
Sarah Lohman's new book is 8 Flavors, The Untold Story of American Cuisine. She joins us from New York today. Listeners, you can join us too. What flavor? says American to you? Or these days, do we have to say, of course we do, flavors? Is sriracha the new ketchup in your house these days? Are you avoiding MSG? It's on her list. We'll look at that. What's the holiday flavor of your American home? It brings out a lot of old country cooking. What would you add to Sarah's list? Her eight flavors: black pepper, vanilla, chili powder, curry powder, soy, garlic, MSG, and sriracha. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
It's hotter than noon, it will melt your spoon. So, buddy, you better get ready for eating hot chili. It's not silly to eat hot chili.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Blue Apron, providing pre-portioned fresh ingredients with easy recipes delivered to your door. Check out this week's menu and get three meals free with free shipping at blueapron.com/onpoint. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the flavors that have defined the full story of American culture and cuisine right up to the very present day. Sarah Lohman is with us, a historical gastronomist, you might say. Her new book is Eight Flavors, The Untold Story of American Cuisine. And you can join us. What flavors say American to you? 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. Online, Sarah, people are saying, well, Dave says, what about ginger? Star says, what about bacon? Patrick says, I remember life before sriracha. It was a bleak and bland time. Yeah, a lot of bacon flavor out there. Plenty of ginger, especially this time of year, and cinnamon as well, as you say.
Yeah, ginger is one I totally looked at when I started with maybe about 40 flavors before I narrowed them down, and it just wasn't as popular as some of the other ones you talked about. But we've not only talked about bacon, but that smoked paprika smokiness. Mm-hmm. That's not a flavor that's one of my chapters, but it is something increasingly
huge.
Popular. Yeah, so in my epilogue, it's called the ninth flavor, and I sort of hypothesize what that next flavor might be. And smoke, even as far as things like liquid smoke or at-home smokers, is something that I talk about is another growing trend in American cooking.
Soy, you've got here. We touched on it briefly, but you say the first soy sauce brewery in the Western Hemisphere was founded in Georgia in the 19th century. Tell us.
Not even the 19th century, 1767, if you can imagine.
Okay, way back.
It was an immigrant from England, and he had traded with China, and the story goes was even imprisoned there for a few years, somehow picked up soy sauce brewing and was making it in Georgia. The English were actually cooking with variations of soy sauce. The same traders that were going and getting things like ginger, cinnamon, black pepper from the Far East were also bringing home soy sauce. But since soy wasn't native to the West, recipes from the 18th and 19th centuries, both in British and American cookbooks, suggest making a similar liquid from walnuts or mushrooms or anchovies. There are sauces today that are modern descendants of these English and American sauces. We mentioned ketchup a little bit earlier. Mm-hmm. Ketchup was originally made with fermented salted tomatoes. Now it's a little thicker and sweeter, but that earlier version was very much a tomato soy sauce, a tomato sauce in a way. So this big ingredient has a connection back to soy sauce.
And soy itself all over the place in American cuisine. Now, Bridget in Harrisonburg, Virginia. Thank you for calling, Bridget. You're on the air with Sarah Lohman.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have a funny story. I grew up in Appalachian, Maryland, but my dad is from Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Okay.
So he brought with him all of the, you know, hatch green chilies, and he would put chilies and eggs and everything, just everything,
yeah.
And the jalapenos and all of that. So we had a lot of that growing up. But then he was, you know, we were also poor in Appalachian, so we had a lot of venison and a lot of ramps. I don't know if you know what ramps are.
The kind of oniony, funky onion.
Wild,
know.
Yeah.
Yes.
Wild leeks, yeah.
Yeah, they smell like, yeah, they smell very bad. And then on top of that,
tastes great.
You're Marylander, so yeah. By, you know, at birth, they give you the Old Bay. So
mm-hmm.
I had this cross-section of American, you know, flavors and cooking growing up, and it's all very funny to see it now. I see a lot of it in, like, hipster culture, and I'm like, wow, I grew up with that. That's cool.
That's pretty. It's pretty great. It's of course, Sarah, not only lines coming in from abroad, but then even within the huge geographic and cultural expanse of this country, you get cross-fertilization.
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel like one of the reasons I wrote this book is that people are very disparaging of American cuisine, even Americans, that it's all McDonald's now. But that's not true. Like whenever I talk to someone just like that story, they want to tell me about their food that they grew up with in their region, like Hatch chilies. You know, New Mexico is so proud of this local chili, and it's such an enormous part of cooking in that area. Regional cuisine has not died out. You can travel in these regions and find amazing cooking that's so specific to tiny areas and sometimes like mashups, like Appalachian Maryland, too.
A little venison and ramps and hot chilies in the mm-hmm. eggs. Stephen Glastonbury, Steve in Connecticut. Thanks for calling, Steve. You're on.
Hi, Tom. You know, I was wondering, I'm going to plead my ignorance here. You've got MSG on your list. I always thought that MSG was that thing that you didn't want on your food. I never thought of it as a spice. And the other thing is, the state of Connecticut, we were known as the nutmeg state, and I believe it was because nutmeg was being imported to us and brought into our country through our canal systems. I was surprised that nutmeg didn't make your list.
Nutmeg state, indeed. No question about that. Take nutmeg up first, Sarah, and then the MSG question. What, a flavor?
Sure. Nutmeg, although we obviously use it, and we used it a lot more, though, in the 19th century. So when I looked at my criteria, I was looking at things that have only grown in popularity since they were first introduced. And nutmeg just isn't as popular as something like black pepper or cinnamon.
This time of year, it's going to hit a lot of eggnog, right?
That's true. It's going to hit a lot of eggnog, and I do love to fresh grate my nutmeg as well. In fact, nutmeg was so popular in the 1840s when it was only available on one little island in Indonesia, and it was in the 1830s that it was finally transplanted and grown in the Caribbean. And so by the 1840s, the price of nutmeg dropped, and within that decade, there were like 20 different nutmeg graters patented. So it was super trendy in the middle of the 19th century. But it's not such a common flavoring in America today.
Justify your monosodium glutamate inclusion on the list of eight flavors, MSG. Steve says, wait, what?
And I think that one of the things a lot of my readers will find fascinating is they lay out a very clear argument as to why we've developed the stereotype that monosodium glutamate is bad for you, but also all the evidence that that isn't true. And I think one of the most important aspects of that is that we call this the sickness, this perceived sickness that people get from MSG, Chinese restaurant syndrome. And so it's really, there's a good dose of xenophobia in the history of how that fear develops. But the big thing that I point out is that MSG is used more broadly in American brands like Kraft or Kentucky Fried Chicken and hundreds, if not thousands, of others than it is in Chinese takeout food. We consume a lot of it every day, and beyond that, it's actually naturally occurring.
Are you using that just as a substitute for umami? Isn't it kind of, aren't these sort of tantamount one to the other?
In fact, when monosodium glutamate was discovered, which was from a Japanese kelp broth, the term that was coined to describe the flavor was umami. It's a Japanese word and essentially means savory taste. Mm-hmm. And since we didn't really have a name for that sensation in our culture, we've borrowed the Japanese word for it. That's where that fifth taste of savory umami comes from. But it exists in many, many foods. Things like Parmesan cheese, tomatoes, for example, soy sauce, these are all very high and naturally occurring amounts of monosodium glutamate. Monosodium glutamate is sodium, salt, plus glutamic acid. Glutamic acid is one of the amino acids that all proteins in the world are made out of. And in fact, it's naturally occurring within our own bodies, as is salt. So this is a bond between sodium and glutamic acid that is not just that white powder. It's found in foods that we eat commonly every day. And it is not an additive in most cases, too. It is naturally occurring as well as it can be used as an additive.
Vincent in Woodbury, Connecticut. Vincent, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Thanks so much for taking my call. Yes, I wanted to expand a bit about the umami question. I'm talking about it, and I've noticed that there's a lot of truffles on restaurant menus these days and a lot of truffles that are being talked about. And, in fact, there's actually truffle cultivation going on here in the United States, in Oregon in particular, where very high-quality black truffles are being grown, and they certainly are high in umami flavor. They're high in glutamic acid, which is the essential part of monosodium glutamate. Can you talk about mushrooms in general, but specifically the truffles and their taste and how they've become very much something that we love here in the United States these days.
Yeah, what's interesting about this this umami is that it's also often called protein taste. Since glutamic acid is in proteins, oftentimes taste or flavor is connecting us to an idea of nutrition or what food is safe or not or what food our body needs. And our body needs protein. What's interesting about it is that sometimes it appears in foods that don't necessarily have a lot of protein. As far as I know, mushrooms aren't very high in protein.
Nope.
So it's kind of an interesting trick that we like this sort of earthy, rich, proteiny taste. And we like it because our bodies want protein, but even we like it in foods that don't necessarily have protein. I wouldn't call – so that's in a reason – that's kind of why I picked a monosodium glutamate at large, so I could talk about these broader flavors. Truffles would definitely have to drop in price before they became a widely spread American ingredient and flavor.
But a mushroom you can grab and grab and hurry. Tom in Milwaukee, thank you for calling, Tom. You're on.
Yeah, hi, Tom. There's three ingredients that I'm wondering about. You mentioned about Italian immigrants to this country, and I'm wondering how – either basil, oregano, and another ingredient, which isn't necessarily Italian, but it's cilantro. I see cilantro popping up all over the place. And I'm wondering how these three didn't make the top eight.
Tom, let us start with the basil and oregano. And if I can, Sarah, let's tie it back to one that did make your list, garlic, which came into popularity, you remind us, along with a wave of Italian immigrants and more. Start with garlic in that story, and then what about basil and oregano on your list?
Yeah, oftentimes in my book, I simply looked at which flavor was the most popular to represent this larger group. So I know that Italian immigration created a massive shift in American culture. Something like by the 1920s, like 1 in 5 Americans was Italian. So, you know, it was this huge immigration into this country. And garlic, out of all of the 8 flavors in the book, is by far the most popular that I use. Just looking at that in terms of basil or oregano, it's far more broadly used in those ingredients and much more popular and can be used to talk about some of the same cultural shifts. One of the things I remind people of in the book is that Americans hated Italian immigrants. They were seen as non-white. They were seen as practicing a non-American religion. And in 1924, we pretty much banned immigration from Italy with the Immigration Act of 1924. That law wasn't overturned until 1965. I bring all this up because garlic at that time was symbolic of what was seen as an Italian's resistance to assimilation to American culture. So both garlic and Italian immigrants were villainized at the turn of the century. Garlic actually becomes popular in American in the middle to late 20th century when chefs like James Beard are really championing Provençal cooking. Mm-hmm. Provence is in the south of France. It borders Italy. It uses a lot of garlic. So we were willing to emulate French culture because we admired it while we were simultaneously rejecting Italian culture.
Boy, that wall sure fell. I mean, you've got Italian restaurants in every corner now, and Americans love it like crazy.
Exactly. And part of that is that now Italian Americans by the 50s and 60s were 2 and 3 generation American born. And so we're more comfortable with their Italian heritage and being proud of it in ways that they weren't allowed to be at the turn of the 20th century. I always think this story is interesting because it represents to me a sense of amnesia we have about how we forget that our grandparents and great-grandparents were treated with the same xenophobia that we treat immigrants in this country today, that a Catholic Italian at the turn of the century is treated similarly how we might treat someone who is Muslim from Bangladesh right now. So I think that's a really important story to remember and one that we can talk about through garlic, of all things.
A few years later, everybody wants a pizza, and there we are, the American story. We're talking about flavors that have and do define American cuisine and culture. The story of sriracha. Now, this is much more recent, and it's kind of exploded. I read this with great interest because I spent many years in Asia and would often be like on a beach in Southeast Asia, big plate of shrimp, and they'd bring out this fiery, wonderful red sauce that I did not associate with home at all. By the time you get to the 1980s and 90s, and of course now, sriracha just exploding in this country. Remind us where it came from.
Well, it actually came from Southern California. And I just saw a news article recently that it's finally being sold in Thailand.
Yeah.
So it was created here. Sort of.
I would say
I tasted
its forebear very, very clearly in Southeast Asia, well before California.
But that word you're using is exactly right. It's forebear. Mm-hmm. What we're consuming in this country is not what's being consumed in Southeast Asia. Mm-hmm. It's new and specific to America. It was created by a man named David Tran. Tran was a refugee after the Vietnam War. His family was ethnically Chinese, and it was a group that was targeted when Saigon fell. He eventually makes it here to America. He's placed as a refugee, as a matter of fact, in Boston in January of 1980. But take a second to think about that, coming from Vietnam to January in Boston.
Yeah.
He told me that he just thought to himself, I need to support my family. He had made hot sauce back in Vietnam. He called his brother, whose brother's family had been placed outside of L.A., and he said, do they have hot peppers there? His brother says, yes. He packed up his family, moved to Southern California, and by February 1980, he's producing sriracha sauce. All the ingredients to this day come from local ingredients, local garlic from mm-hmm. Gilroy, California, jalapeno peppers grown just a few hours north of L.A. And it is a sauce that he thought, okay, there's going to be a lot of Vietnamese people living here. They want a sauce from home, but it's a little different from anything at home and really captured the hearts of Americans.
You visited, I think when you visited, there were 200,000 barrels of this sauce fermenting, getting
oh
ready
gosh.
For the market.
Yeah, they process it all between essentially August and November. That processing season also might have already grown since the time I was there, because every year the demand for sriracha grows and grows and grows. In fact, every year since February of 1980, they have not been able to produce enough to meet demand. The demand has grown every year. And this story – oh, please, go ahead.
No, I just wondered what you see coming over the horizon in terms of flavors that are emergent in American cuisine and culture now.
Yeah, that really connects to actually what I was going to say. What kind of strikes a chord with me with sriracha is that this is a family of refugees. And to me, when I hear in the news all the talk about preventing refugees from coming to this country from the Middle East, to me, that strikes me as frankly un-American, because Tran came here, contributed to this country, our culture. He has this true American story of starting this business by himself. And we are giving – we're not giving an entire generation of future Americans a chance to come here and do the same thing, whether that's like in this case like cuisine or something else. And I mention that because the new trends are coming from the Middle East. Rosewater, cardamom, za'atar – these are what the next wave of immigration is bringing.
Bring me that cardamom. I'll be very happy to have it. Yeah, what a country with people from all over and often tension in their arrival, and yet their cuisines melt into ours and become such beloved parts of American cuisine and culture. Sarah Lohman writes it all up in her new book, Eight Flavors, The Untold Story of American Cuisine. Sarah, wonderful to have you with us today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for the chance.
Great, great stories. Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
In case you haven't heard the latest news, there is a special sauce that I overuse on party pizza, wings, or anything that moves. I'm talking about sriracha. It's the sauce I choose. Sriracha wrap. Sriracha wrap. Sriracha wrap. Sriracha wrap. Sriracha wrap.